Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Killer Jeans, part two of our special series on the case of Bianca Jones and DeAndre Lane.
It was a body search. It was always a cadaver search. They were always just looking for where we dumped her.
A possible key piece of evidence is allegedly disregarded by law enforcement.
They never brought in the evidence. For all I know, it's still laying on the ground somewhere.
And DeAndre's possible motive for killing his daughter is revealed.
What was the motive that the prosecution painted for the jury of why DeAndre allegedly killed his two-year-old daughter?
Because she went to bed.
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised.
Emmy-nominated true crime journalists bring you cases like you've never heard them before. Hear firsthand accounts from the victims' families, private investigators, lawyers, law enforcement, and even the convicted. Giving you a complete 360 of the case like no one else can.
I'm Melissa McCarty.
I'm Kelly McClear.
And this is Killer Jeans.
Detroit, Michigan, 2011.
Neighborhood was a battle zone. I saw people die. I saw my first murder when I was 4 or 5 years old. I'll never forget it. This is a notoriously not great neighborhood. Notoriously not great neighborhood. Forever and always, this neighborhood has been bad. Going back to Al Capone days, the Purple Gang comes out of this neighborhood. The people that did the St. Valentine's Day massacre lived in this neighborhood. This neighborhood has always been one of the places that people go through during 80. And after an economic collapse, a desperate neighborhood only gets, it turns into the Thunderdome. Basically, you trapped here with no resources. It turns into a Thunderdome.
Army veteran Bianca Jones, who is also known as Pinky, was born and raised in Detroit. But in 2011, her home would turn into her nightmare when her two-year-old daughter Bianca was kidnapped in an alleged carjacking.
Bianca was with her father, DeAndre Lane, when he says another car flagged him down, so he pulled over. It was then that one of the two men in the car pulled a gun on DeAndre and took off with the vehicle. Bianca was still in her car seat. He tried to run after the cars, but they fled out of sight. DeAndre ran to Pinky's house just a few blocks away and got someone to call 911.
And her father is really upset. Somebody must have hijacked him or something, and my niece is in the car.
Okay, how old is she?
She's two.
Did they use a weapon on him? Which way did they go? What kind of vehicle was it?
Dre, come on. You need to talk to me, sweetheart. Oh, my God. I remember. Dre.
That's 253, Custer. Dre.
The Detroit Police Department starts their investigation and puts out a Michigan Amber Alert for Bianca. While DeAndre is being detained on an unrelated outstanding warrant, the vehicle he was driving is found just a few blocks from Pinky's house. Pinky, what was your reaction when you heard that the vehicle had been found?
I thought, okay, they found her. Like, okay, that's it. That this is over. Thank God. Because I was like, oh, my God, I can't take much more of this. I thought I was dying, literally, like, oh, this is going to kill me. I'm having a stroke, a slow-motion stroke. So they found the car, and yes, finally, yes, this is over. Let's get the baby back, and whoo, yes. And then they were like, oh, she's not in it. And it was like, what? And then my mind just, like, went like, what? Like, did she get out? Did she walk off? Did you look?
Did they look? Did law enforcement look for your daughter?
In my opinion, they looked for evidence that would show them what they wanted to believe, which is, yes, just they looked for proof that, yeah, we did it. We just need to find proof they did it.
The vehicle has been found, but no sign of Bianca. Her car seat and blanket, though, were still in the back seat.
Well, there was a Detroit search and rescue dog, a tracking
dog.
Their
dog, I believe, took them to a building which had a ski mask in it. And DeAndre told them that the man that took the car from him was wearing a knit cap. And so the dog took you to a ski mask. That might be something of importance. Let's pick this up and maybe it's something we should look into. And I'm going to quote the prosecutor here, a ski mask is not a hat.
DeAndre remembers hearing about the tracking dog's findings.
The dog went to the car. The dog tracked in the opposite direction of Bianca's mother's house to an apartment building and retrieved a ski mask or a skull cap. It was either a ski mask or a skull cap, which matched the description of the one that I said that the driver was wearing. And they did not place it into evidence because they thought it was irrelevant to the case.
So they disposed of this mask?
They never brought in the evidence. For all I know, it's still laying on the ground somewhere.
Even DeAndre's defense attorney, Terry Johnson, questioned why the ski mask wasn't taken into evidence.
Well, that's the amazing part. The dogs followed a scent, and the dog found a skull cap, for lack of a better term. I believe it had, the holes in it for the eyes and everything else. And that evidence was just disregarded. It was not a big thing. As a matter of fact, I was the person that called that particular officer to the stand who had to testify of what the dog did and what the dog found. And believe it or not, they didn't really even take this into evidence for all practical purposes.
They didn't check it for DNA?
Did not check it for DNA, never ran analysis on it, anything. Because again, the question that the prosecution truly played with was, there's no way that this could have happened. No one's going to take a 2-year-old baby. And that was their complete theory, as opposed to, well, wait a minute, it's very possible that this happened. And they never believed my client from the beginning, even though there was evidence of the sort that someone else was there.
With an investigation by the Detroit Police Department and even the FBI, investigators do not believe there was even a carjacking in the first place. They believe DeAndre made the whole thing up to cover the fact that he killed his daughter and disposed of her body. But Bianca has never been found.
And what I'm saying is, like, when you grow up in that certain area, when you live a certain kind of lifestyle, there's certain rules. And one of the rules is you never talk to the police. In your Miranda rights, they say everything that you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. They don't say what you say can be used to help you. They tell you flat out everything you say can and will be used against you. So it's imperative when you deal with the police, like, you don't, if they arrest you, just be quiet. And that's the rule that I usually stick to. This situation was different because it was pertaining to my child and I was a victim of a situation. Now, if it had been something with just me by myself, I would have said anything. You know, but because of the fact that my daughter was involved with this and my daughter was missing, I felt I had to speak. I had to let them know what was going on. However, off bail, it was like I was under attack. That's what I felt. I felt straight up under attack. And several times I told them, like, I don't even want to talk to you guys anymore. Because every time I said something, it was like, you're lying. There was no carjacking. I'm like, how you going to tell me what happened to me? Like, you weren't there. We know what happened. I'm like, I'm telling you what happened. No, you're a liar. You know, say a guy making comments, somebody had a demon in me, and all kind of just crazy stuff. So anybody who knows me they know this. I have made many mistakes in my life. You know what I'm saying? I'm not a perfect person. But when it comes to my family and when it comes to my children, I defend that. You know, I stand by that. I will do anything for them. And for this person to just come in not knowing me at all and just attacking my character, attacking my fatherhood, you know what I'm saying? Basically just, I mean, I got upset. And I think that anybody in my situation would. I mean, because it's like, here you are, you're supposed to be here to help me. Like, I know I've done wrong. But at the same time, the police are supposed to be here to serve and protect. You're supposed to be helping me. And you're doing nothing to help me whatsoever. Like, while y'all doing this, my daughter is God knows where. And God knows what is happening to her. And y'all sitting up here trying to blame me for something. I'm a victim.
What would Pinky think about the Detroit PD feeling DeAndre was responsible for Bianca's death? It seems like you never doubted DeAndre's version of events. Is that true, or did you have a moment when you did?
I don't have, no. Why? I mean, I don't know. DeAndre wouldn't lie to me about something like this. And I asked him point blank, DeAndre, what happened? Did you do this? And he told me, no. No, I swear on him. He sweared on his mama. And if you knew DeAndre and his love for his mama, you would know that's a big deal. No. I don't have, and even now I have people that be like, come on, girl, you know, I don't know. And until somebody can show me some evidence, no. I mean, that's what I did in the military. What it really boiled down to, my job was collecting evidence. Chain of custody, securing evidence, tamper proof and evidence. So show me this evidence that you collected properly, that you secured properly, tamper proofed properly, that indicates that this man did these things you say he did. Give me something besides the police's narrative.
DeAndre Lane is arrested and charged with child abuse and the murder of his 2-year-old daughter, Bianca. The prosecution begins to build their case and establish a timeline of the last 24 hours. What you are going to hear next is DeAndre recounting those hours. The case begins the evening of December 1st.
That night, you know, we like everything is normal. We are, we all ate. You know, I cooked dinner for us. We all ate. I had my nephew over at the time, Trayvon, and you know, we were all just at the house chilling. I had the girls. I was around that. We started probably around that night when I was getting the girls was getting ready for bed. We got them tucked in bed, and it was like me, Anjali, and my nephew. We were hanging out, watching TV and stuff, joking around, playing around and stuff. Anjali wound up going to sleep, so she went upstairs to go to bed, and, you know, me and my nephew were down there. We were watching movies. Sometime during the night, I heard a bump coming from the girls' room, and when I went back there, Bibi was on the floor. She was like, potty, daddy, potty. So she had to go to the bathroom. So I got her, took her to the bathroom. Everything was fine, you know, but I wound up keeping her up because I didn't know, like, when she fell out the bed or whatever. I didn't know if she jumped out the bed, fell out the bed or whatever. So I kept her with me for, like, you know what I'm saying, about 30 minutes or so just to make sure that she was coherent, she was up and everything. And once I figured she was fine, let's put her back in the bed and, you know what I'm saying, she was, put her to sleep.
It was enough of a thump for you to be concerned as a father.
When I heard it, you know what I'm saying, I heard it and I was like, okay, what's going on? Now, I do want to say earlier that evening, she had an accident. And this is where the situation with the police trying to say that I abused her came in at, because earlier that day when she had the accident, I actually spanked her because she had an accident. You know what I'm saying? And I'm the first person to say that I do discipline my children. I do spank my children. I do put my children on punishment. I give them time out, all kind of, I use all different types of tools when it comes to rearing my children. I'm not going to sit here and say that I don't spank my children. I do. But I don't abuse or beat my children. There's never been anybody who came forward, a child's mother or anybody else, that actually has ever witnessed me abusing any Clint Beebe earlier that evening because he actually, you know, had a bathroom situation.
And
however,
was
that
it a,
night,
was it a spanking?
Yes.
With your hand?
No, at that time, I think I used the little paddle I had. It's like, and that's what it was brought up at the at trial. It's a paddle. There's a stick, and it has like a pad on the bottom, on the end of it. And, you know, I use that. And I don't hit them nowhere but on their butt. So I believe I like popping on the butt with that. I generally, when it's a situation with the bathroom, I generally ask them, like, you know, where do you use the bathroom, you know, and take them to the potty and show them what they got, where they're supposed to use the bathroom at, and things like that. And I think we went through that whole situation of where are you supposed to go to the bathroom. She says in the potty, like, okay, are you supposed to pee in your room? No. Anywhere else? No. In the potty? Okay. And it's generally like it's not a repetitive thing, maybe about two to three pats on the butt, and then it's not sit on the pot, you know. And this is something that has, this is like, you know, a regular thing. Like, I've never exceeded the bounds. Like, you never hear. That's why everybody that you hear talk about whatever they heard me spank my children, they're like, maybe he probably hit on the butt like two, three times. Like, there's never been a thing where they're like, oh, he hit like eight times. That's never the case. And they say even my children's mothers, other people who testified that actually seen me discipline my children before, they never saw me do anything ever that was on the lines of abuse. So I keep her up with me and Travion in the living room for, you know, about 30 minutes or so, just to make sure, like, how she's looking. And, you know, I didn't feel any lumps or bumps on her head or anything like that, but I didn't know what happened. And I remember from growing up and from me just dealing with children in general, I was always told, like, if you don't know when a child hit their head, like, keep them up to make sure they don't got a concussion or, you know, say nothing like that. If they look like, if they fall out of anything, you can take them to the hospital. So she was, like, you know, set up. She was standing around, and I was like, you good? You know, I'm talking to her. I'm looking at her. Like, she was fine, so I put her back in the bed. Me and Travion, we watched some more TV, and then I went upstairs and got to bed and went to sleep.
The morning of December 2nd.
I woke up at around, like, 6:30, you know, and I started, you know, getting everything together. I'm the one who usually get everybody up and get breakfast going and things of that nature. So when I got up, the first thing I did is went to go check on the girls. I made sure I took Addison, put her on the potty first. And so I got the shower ready for Alandra. She started getting ready for school, getting ready, got in the shower. I got Addison squared away, and then I put Addison back in the bed. Alandra went to go start eating her breakfast, and then I put Bibi on the potty while, you know, since I was getting Alandra taken care of, I had to change her clothes and everything and get her ready. So I put her clothes in the hamper. Got her washed up, cleaned up, and everything, and I put her clothes on. Set her on the couch where Travion was after he got ready, and then I went and got myself ready. So, you know what I'm saying? Travion and Lalandra were, you know what I'm saying, in the same room with Bibi for a while. It took me about at least 10, 15 minutes before I got myself together, came back downstairs and got myself together. So that was a lengthy amount of time that she's sitting there with them. You know, and Lalandra got ready. She got ready to eat. She's done eating. Got her coat set on. And this is when Lisa, who was my roommate at the time, came home. I believe we left. I'm not exactly sure of the time right now, but it was around 7 something when we left the house. You know, start getting everybody prepared. And this is so crazy to me because here it is. We're in December, and people are, like, denigrating me because I covered my daughter up when I took her out of the house. I mean, like, what parent who knows how to parent does not bundle their child up and cover their heads up when they're leaving out the house in December early in the morning?
DeAndre, what was your plan that morning?
So my morning route was I had my nephew with me. So I was dropping him off at my sister's house, which was, like, you know, only about a couple minutes away from where we were. Then from there, I would take Alandra to school. And after I dropped Alandra off at school, I had to go run down to WC3 to get my my stuff together for the upcoming semester. And then from there, I was going to go to Pinky's house to get BB's clothes and everything like that. And, you know, just get some things together with her. And then I was going to, supposed to be back home so that Anjali and Lisa can get to school and work. Like a regular day, like it was nothing abnormal about the day, you know what I'm saying?
And then you went over to the college.
Yeah, after dropping her off, I continued on to the college. Now, when I get to the college, I realized that I didn't have my briefcase. I forgot to grab my briefcase. So I called and I asked Lisa, did she see it? And she's like, yeah, it's right here next to the, on the couch, next to the couch. So I'm like, dang, you know. I'm like, all right, I got to be back to go. I'm coming right back to grab it after I grab these clothes. She's like, all right. So I leave WC3 going towards
Bodega Wait, Towns wait, wait. Go back. Go back to the college. You ran into a friend, Rico Blackwell.
Yes, this is when I was leaving the college on my way to go to Bonica's house. I ran into Rico Blackwell, and when I saw Rico, I was like, you know, blew the horn. And he like, yeah, he like, what's up? You know, stop talking, because I hadn't seen him in a minute because he was going to the school when I previously was going there, but I hadn't seen him because he had left. And you know, I saw him. Catching up real quick, like, hey, what's going on? We exchanged phone numbers, you know what I'm saying? I even said, like, hey, you know, this man, because he knows Bonica as well. He knows Pinky as well and her family. We all grew up together. So I'm like, you know what I'm saying? I even told him, I'm like, yeah, this man, Pinky's daughter right here. He's like, oh, okay, that's what's up. I'm like, I'm about to go to her house right now. He's like, oh, okay, cool. I'm about to go to school. I got a test to do. And there's another thing. I'm like, all right, well, I'm going to let you go ahead and go because I got to get over here. And then we parted ways there.
After leaving the college, DeAndre, with Bianca in the back seat, made his way over to Pinky's house. It was just a few blocks from her house where DeAndre says the carjacking occurred.
So, and I want to also clarify, too, you had an arrangement with Pinky to bring BB to the house to pick up clothes and hang out for a few so she could see her. However, when you got to the house that morning, or, you know, when you frantically busted in the door, Pinky was not there.
How long after did she arrive home, and did someone call her to rush home?
I believe somebody called her. I don't recall how long it was. I can't really give an estimate to that.
I believe
it was quickly, because around the time the police got there, she was there.
And when you saw her for the first time and you said, you know, our baby's gone, what was her reaction? Was she screaming, wailing? How did she react?
I just remember her trying to calm me down. I remember her saying, Dre, you're usually the calm one. You got to calm down. You're usually the calm one. I'm not usually the calm one. You're usually the calm one. You got to calm down. And just let us know what happened.
What else did she say?
She's like, everything's going to be all right.
But everything was not going to be all right. DeAndre was put on trial for the murder of his daughter, Bianca. What ensued in the days, weeks, and months following would turn into a community and media circus. The big question remains still to this day. What would DeAndre's motivation be to kill his own daughter? DeAndre's defense attorney, Terry Johnson. What was the motive that the prosecution painted for the jury of why DeAndre allegedly killed his 2-year-old daughter?
Because she went to bed. She went to bed. He was a bad dad. He was very strict, and he had this stick that he beat the hell out of his kids with. And, you know, they made statements about how bad everything was, but nobody came to the stand and said that.
Investigators and prosecutors say that DeAndre killed his daughter sometime the evening of December 1st and morning of December 2nd in a fit of rage over a potty training accident. But remember, there was a witness to the activities that night and the next morning, DeAndre's nephew, Travion Lane.
Let's just first start off by telling me what your relationship was like with your uncle DeAndre back in 2011.
My relationship with my uncle was basically like, I can basically say my uncle was like a pop, like my father to me. He was always there when it came to going to school, doing hair, cutting my hair, everything. He basically groomed me into the man I am today.
You were around him a lot, and DeAndre was around his kids a lot. What was he like as a father that you saw personally?
He was a great father. He was more so hard on us boys than he was on the girls, and that's because he always wanted what was best for us. You know, growing up, he always wanted what's best for us, and always wanted us to reach our full potential.
So you never saw any abuse, yelling, violence, rage?
No, but he wasn't really like that. If you ask me personally.
So tell me about the night of December 1st of 2011. You were at DeAndre's house that night. What did you guys do?
He had cut my hair, and we was basically up all night watching Dragon Ball Z. He had like this series of Dragon Ball Z. He had like all the CDs to Dragon Ball Z. So we was basically up just watching Dragon Ball Z, kicking it, you know, like how uncles and nephews supposed to do. You know, he was basically, you know, telling me, you know, we stayed up all night that night, basically till about 3-4 in the morning.
Now, at some point when you guys are watching videos and hanging out in the early morning hours of December 2nd, you guys heard something. What did Dre do when he heard a noise down the hall?
He went in there and brought the baby. He brought Bianca back up to the front room with us. And I think he changed her and made sure she was good. And then he kept her out there for a little bit with me and him. And we was kicking it and stuff. And then he took her back. When he was done, he took her back in the back room and laid her down.
And when she was in the living room with you guys, she was fine? Awake, talking, making sounds?
Yeah, she was walking.
She was walking around?
Yeah, she was walking around. He had her walking around on her own. She was like standing up in front of us, you know.
So all was good?
Yep.
And then tell me about that next morning.
The next morning, my uncle woke me up. He had me go to the bathroom. He's like, you know, get yourself together, you know, so I can take you home. Basically went to the bathroom, clean myself up. And that's when he brought little Bianca out in the front and set her on the couch and put on her coat.
And you hung out with her in the living room for a little bit?
Yeah, she was sitting right next to me on the couch, and she was just, you know, normal, chilling, doing what babies do.
She wasn't sleeping?
No, she wasn't sleeping at all.
Her eyes were open?
Her eyes were open. She was, like, wide awake.
And it was early morning, right? Wasn't it, like, 6:30, 7 a.m.?
Early morning, yeah, you could tell she was a little tired.
But there was nothing about her demeanor or her actions that made you go, something's wrong with BB?
No, not at all.
And tell me what happened after that.
First, he warms the car up first because it was the wintertime. He goes, I warm the car up after he sat her on the couch to me. He goes and warm the car up. Then he grabs her and take her out there. And then we follow me and Elandra follow after him. I'm in the front seat, and he drives me home.
And she was alive in the car seat.
Yeah, she was wide awake.
Because what I always have an issue with this case, right? It's like, would he have, if Bianca was apparently dead, why would he go through all these steps to put her in the car, put Elandra in the car, put you in the car, ask you to hang out with him for the day and go on his route and all of his runs when apparently Bianca was dead in the car seat? It doesn't make sense to me.
She was alive. That's why.
So, Melissa, by arresting and charging DeAndre with Bianca's murder, the Detroit PD and prosecutors are saying that DeAndre beat his child to death, then rode around with her all morning, dead in her car seat, dropped off Travion and Elandra, stopped to talk to Rico Blackwell, then staged a carjacking to make people think she was kidnapped. But remember, Travion says Bianca was alive that morning with her eyes open.
Kelly, I think that scenario is just simply too far-fetched and frankly morbid. If he did kill her, it didn't go down the way that the prosecutors presented in court or for the motive that they presented. And then what about all of these conflicting testimonies?
Travion wasn't the only witness to Bianca being alive that morning. DeAndre's roommate Lisa Dungy had come home that morning from an evening out and to let DeAndre take the car to run his morning errands.
I did peek into the girls' room, and I only say that because I smoked cigarettes in the bathroom with the window open, so I checked into the room. I had to close the girls' bedroom door, you know, just so, and I would go in the bathroom, and I saw, you know, Addison was asleep, but I did see Vivi. She was up, but she was still laying down. And I know I saw her. Her eyes were open, and she looked at me. You know what I'm saying? So I testified that I saw the baby alive that morning in my home.
What is interesting about this case is what the investigation and prosecutors think he did with Bianca's body.
I assume you remember the FBI ride-along that you did, and one of the agents kept asking you, why were you on the east side of 75 on St. Aubyn Street? What was the significance of that area, and why did they keep asking you about that particular area?
Okay, now, this is what was brought to my attention. My attention was, it was told to me that on the east side of St. Aubyn Street is the incineration thing for, like, the trash, where they do the pickup for the trash, and where they incinerate trash. So, I guess that they were, one of their hypotheses is that maybe I took her body to the trash place and, you know what I'm saying, for it to be incinerated. Which doesn't make any sense to me because it's not like you can just walk up to the place and be like, hey, yeah, I got this stuff I want to burn up. But that's not how it works.
Dre, on the record, were you ever over by the incinerator area off of St. Aubyn Street?
No, I never crossed I-75.
Pinky also has her thoughts on the incinerator theory.
It was a body search. It was always a cadaver search. They were always just looking for where we dumped her. And they really concentrated around this area where they suspected DeAndre's route was between here and the university. So let's look everywhere he was, where he might have dumped the body.
And finally,
when they could not find her, they settled on, okay, yeah, he took her to the incinerator. Which, I've driven past the incinerator a bunch of times. You can't just drive in there. There are cameras all over every entrance. It's a government facility. You can't just, any old civilian can't just drive their car into the incinerator. There would be no end of jumping drugs and guns and bodies in the incinerator if that was possible. You know the city would have some kind of precaution against that exact type of behavior. But they want me to believe that in broad daylight, this man drove his civilian vehicle into the incinerator without ever passing any cameras or guards and dumped the corpse of a child and nobody noticed or got it on camera or notated it at all. In a government facility, in broad daylight, on a sunny day? I don't think so.
Defense attorney Terry Johnson is not buying the incinerator theory either.
Just makes no sense to me that a two-year-old can go missing in a city like Detroit and she just vanishes. Now, the police, if you go back to a lot of things that they claim they did, you know, they want you to believe that my client took a body to the incinerator and just dropped it off. And anybody who knows, and I believe I said this in my closing, you just can't drive up to an incinerator within the city of Detroit. You've got to have passes to get in. There have to be inspections and other things. And again, the prosecution just ran with that theory.
It wasn't one of the other theories was that she was dumped, her body was dumped in the river behind WC3 College?
That was another theory, and that didn't pan out because, again, there's no video of my client going anywhere near the river.
DeAndre recalls a few other issues with the vehicle and the area where it was found.
Here's another thing. Now, you had this, you had a prosecution saying that I drove the car and I parked the car where the car was found at. Now, in the area where the car is found, there's snow and mud everywhere on the car on both sides. When you look at my shoes that I wore, they were indoor running shoes. When you look at the shoes that I wore, there's no mud whatsoever on my shoes. When you look at the footprints that are in the ground, in the mud and in the snow, in the surrounding areas of the car, none of those shoe prints match my shoe. Like, even looking at the pictures, you can, like, basically, the shoe prints all around the car were basically like boot prints. Like, they had close-up pictures of the tracks, of different tracks leading away from the car. All of these were like kind of like boot prints. Because we're in the wintertime, mind you. It's wintertime. So most people are wearing boots. I wasn't really getting out of my car that much, so I had my indoor slip-on running shoes that I usually have at the front door that I could just throw on my feet. None of those prints match those shoes.
But
you have the prosecution saying that.
Did they dust for fingerprints in the vehicle?
They dust for fingerprints, found no fingerprints, not even mine.
Which would lead
you to believe that somebody took time to wipe the car down.
Wait, they didn't even find your fingerprints anywhere around the vehicle?
Didn't even find my fingerprints. They said they found no usable prints anywhere in the car.
Were you wearing gloves that day because it was wintertime?
No. No gloves, no nothing. No prints. Not even any of the children's prints. Not my nephew's prints, nobody's prints on any of the door handles or anything.
What was the prosecution's, reasoning for all of this?
Oh, I could have wiped it all down.
And change your shoes?
Yeah, like, your guess is as good as mine.
Another theory and rumor that has spread over the years is that Bianca's own mother, Pinky, might be responsible for her disappearance.
The narrative that I've been told is, well, we don't think he honestly did it. They don't really think he did it. They think I set him up. They think I planned this, that I set him up, that I framed him, that I kidnapped my own daughter and I'm hiding her somewhere. Well, the FBI called my father and told my father that I'm scary smart. And so they know that I know more than I'm telling.
What did they say was your motive for setting DeAndre up and hiding Bianca?
He had a girlfriend and they had a baby. And I was jealous that he was going to leave me for this girl, and so I set him up to go to prison for life, causing him to leave me for life, which makes no sense when, if you look at the fact that, yes, he did have a girlfriend. Yes, they did have a daughter. Bianca was younger than that child, which means after he met his girlfriend, after she got pregnant. We were still messing around. So So why would I think he was going to leave me for her?
So, DeAndre, you know, a lot of people have suspected that Pinky might have been involved in some way. What are your thoughts on those rumors?
Well, like I said, to my understanding and from what I know of Pinky, like, and she knows me, I feel like this would be totally a counterproductive way to get at me, and she would know that. But I do believe that there are people, individuals in her family that could have had something to do with this or know something about this, and they're not saying anything because of the way that they reacted when the whole situation took place. I mean, these are people that I've known for 20, 30 years. So for them to act the way that they acted without even talking to me or getting any kind of information and just straight up like the mob just came out, it's like, to me, that was strange. Because these are people that when they've been in situations, I've been there, and I've always had their back and supported them no matter what was going on, and found out what was really happening before I based an opinion on something. It's like they came out the woodwork. It's like, oh, yeah, he did this. He did it without any kind of provocation, any kind of evidence to the nature of what they were speaking on. This is just how they came out. And with all the other things that were being said prior to the situation being the way that it is, like with her family asking me to take custody of Bianca from her and, you know, spreading rumors about her being addicted to drugs and having all kind of other stuff going on, it just seems strange to me that now this happens and now you point the finger at me without any kind of evidence or any kind of information to prove that.
Yeah, so, I mean, law enforcement, you know, she even said that law enforcement looked at her and said, we know you had something to do with this. Have the two of you had conversations about that?
I mean, we have talked about it, and, you know, like she said, she knows that people feel like she's had something to do with it, and that some of the things that she's done or hasn't done subsequently after the situation kind of make her look like she might have had something to do with it. Like, a lot of people say her reaction and the way that she's failed to kind of really keep, you know what I'm saying, things going, or, you know what I'm saying, put herself in the forefront of everything, has kind of be like, they're like, you know, say, I had some people be like, well, if that was my child, I would be out there every day, or I would have this done, or I would be doing this, and I would be doing that. And I can understand their mindset as it pertains to that. But from my understanding of who I know her to be, I just don't believe that she would do something like this to get at me, because, like I said, it would be totally counterproductive. Be a surprise. Like I say, some people in her family, I could see that. But her, herself, it would be a surprise to me. I wouldn't see that coming.
On the next episode of Killer Jeans.
Here we go. Now, this is time. According to the prosecution, this is what they said. They say that Bianca died that night, and I was carrying around a dead body all that morning.
The investigation deploys a widely controversial investigation tool.
I can't cross-examine a dog. They asked the dog what the dog was barking at, so it kind of put me in a very difficult position as well.
And the past of the prosecution's star witness is revealed. Was he credible?
Oh, Rico. I would have never guessed in a million years that Rico Blackwell would come back to haunt me.